In case anyone was wondering, I would not have made it through Lowland. I
no,
would have
me neither.
For sure. I would have dove into a grave and been like, please just throw all the dirt on me. I'm over it.
Lillian's like, can I please go to sleep and stay asleep forever? Thank you. Well, hi, Lillian. How's it going?
It's going good. It's very weird to be talking to you on a Monday.
I agree. It is different. But, you know, maybe we've got this beginning of the week energy that's going to make things a little different instead of end of the week energy.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Our listeners, our eagle-eyed listeners, or eagle-eared, will know that note if they're listening, if they always wake up Monday mornings and they're like, it's 8 a.m., time for a new AirBuds. They woke up disappointed this morning, and I'm so sorry to them. My grandma was visiting me this weekend, and it was sort of a last minute thing, and I did do a forget about AirBuds, and so we had to change our recording schedule around that.
And it's totally cool because you guys could go back and check out all of our previous episodes. You know, it's we're doing a character study today.
Yes.
So maybe you went back and you were checking out the Rochester one or the Jane one or all those other guys. So, you know, dig in the Bertha episode, figure out, you know, the details because we're getting down and dirty with Helen Burns, Miss Temple and the River Sisters today.
Yeah, we have 72 other episodes. You can go back and listen to at any time.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, as you should. But yeah, today we got these three ladies. Mm-hmm. Lillian, just kind of off the top of your head, why do you think these three, or technically four, why do you think these four people are good to talk about in connection with one another?
I think it's interesting. Helen and Miss Temple meet Jane at like a similar point in her life, and they play a really similar role in sort of adjusting her perspective. And then I think the reason Mary and Diana, we specifically included in this conversation, because they're not enough of characters to have a whole episode about them. Mm-hmm. But I think the reason that these four fit together for me is they're the really positive female friendships that Jane has at super pivotal points in their life. Yeah. And I see a lot of parallels in the way Jane's perspective shifts when she's that in that childhood at Lowood and in this sort of new, first new experience. And then how her perspective shifts in what I refer to in my head as the St. John chunk. Mm-hmm. Because it does make me so angry. But in the book, I think that we talked a lot about that idea of how that finding that female friendship really reframes things for Jane.
Yeah.
And so I think that it's how do these female friendships, for me, that's where a lot of my thoughts kind of center. So how do these female friendships affect the way that Jane is like changing her perspective on things? Because it's something that we certainly didn't see a lot at the time. And mm-hmm. we still don't see a lot of well-represented female friendships today.
Yeah.
But every woman I know, mm-hmm. Female friendships are the center of kind of who they are. And they're so important to what it means to be a woman and to sort of experience the world. And I know for me, without my friends like you, my life would be a lot darker.
Well, we're here to give you sunshine, Lillian, and support always.
Thank you.
And I completely agree. I think it's so interesting, like you said, that the pivotal moments in Jane's life. So when she is this little child and she meets Helen and she meets Miss Temple, those are positive relationships that contribute, I think, to the forming of Jane's, some of her key personality traits. And it's something that I'm going to talk about specifically when we go into details about these women. But I think there's a lot that Jane does where she kind of models herself after these two women because they meant a lot to her and they were very kind in a time when she needed that. And that was something that then led to them having an influence. And then when she has already kind of established herself as a person, and but yet she finds herself in this traumatic, lonely experience, once again, female friendship enters her life and it kind of helps her develop this independence and find this support network. So yeah, I'm very excited to dive into these. But we're starting with Helen.
Yes.
And I don't know about you, but even though I can't remember word for word things from the Hot and Bothered playlist, every time I wrote down a note or a thought, my brain said, am I taking this from what they said? Because they like did some really interesting discussions on Helen when they were going through the novel.
For sure. I think I have gotten to a point in just the amount of information I have taken in from other sources about Jane Eyre that I have no idea what thoughts are originally mine and what are ones that we got DMs from listeners about, what are ones that I read in some article that I saw, because the internet has figured out I'm obsessed with Jane Eyre. And so I get a lot of Jane Eyre content.
Awesome. But that's the thing. I feel like I'm going to start sounding like a broken record, but one thing that I love about discussing this story is how different elements, how the conversation of Jane Eyre influences Jane Eyre itself and makes us Absolutely. Reinterpret the work. So, yeah.
And I also think something that was coming up for me a lot in preparing for this and kind of thinking about how I wanted to discuss particular elements of like Helen and Miss Temple and what these relationships are like is I think something you and I have in common that isn't necessarily better than the way that other people read the text, but is something that not everyone feels about Jane Eyre. And there's been a couple particular examples I've seen this week, is you and I very much, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, are the kind of people where we can look at this and go, oh, let's like examine this from all sides. Like there's not a right answer for how to interpret Jane Eyre. These are just all interesting ways to think about it, interesting ways to see it. It's one of the reasons why we enjoy doing what we do and going through these adaptations. We definitely have things that we're like, that is a misinterpretation. That is like the wrong way to see it. But we also aren't like, this is the right answer. And there's particular theories that I want to talk about with Helen that I'm like, I'm not saying that's what Charlotte Bronte meant. I'm not saying that's even in the text. Mm-hmm. I'm saying some people think that, and I think that's interesting, and I think it's worth discussing.
Let's go into it. Are we talking about how Helen and Jane, there's kind of like a romance element to their relationship? Yeah.
It's very childlike and sweet. Mm-hmm. Like it's those childhood crushes. But so I'm not saying that these two had a sexual relationship. That's real intense and not at all what I'm saying.
Not but sexual love.
There is like an element of like a bit more than friendship, like a bit more than what we would call friendship today. And I also think the idea of friendship is something that I want to discuss more in this as well, because there are elements of like Jane has what I would consider other friends in this. But she does not refer to them as friends. And when she's talking to Rochester and he asks her about a friend and she says she had a friend once, but she died.
Yeah.
I'm like, that's your one friend? Oh. You don't even consider Miss Temple a friend? Mm-hmm. What? Explain to me what a friendship is.
I wonder if for the Miss Temple thing, it's partially because she was this older kind of parental figure for her. So maybe she doesn't view that as a friendship. That's a different kind of relationship in her brain. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I guess because when Helen is sick, she talks about a couple of the other girls that she would spend some time with when they were off in the woods avoiding the plague house. Yeah. But I guess it must be for Jane a matter of like, how much does she open up to someone for them to become a friend versus just an acquaintance or a companion? Because I think that seems to be a big thing for her, is that if she opens up to another individual and like kind of, you know, shows her vulnerability or expresses like certain emotions and things, then that is someone that she would deem friend.
So, yeah. And I also think there's a layer of like almost a level of commitment. And like, that's, again, not to imply like relationship, but like there's it's almost like I say like best friend now, and that's like a tier for me. Like I don't have one best friend. I have people who are at a certain level of friendship that's a tier. Yeah. And it almost feels more like somebody, like there's a lot of people that I'd be like, oh, of course. Yeah. We're friends. We used to work together or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, that I don't think Jane would be like, that's a friend. But I think that like our friendship, that's like a best friend level for me. And like, there's a couple other people, I'm sure you could name all of the people in my life that I would call like a best friend. And I feel like that's more, it's just like a language difference in the way that they, like, as opposed to an acquaintance or someone you know, like you said.
Yeah.
It's a distinction there.
Yeah.
And I think that's interesting.
I am also thinking about, so it makes sense that she would be not one to readily like offer mm-hmm. friendship or bestow that title because of, you know, the trauma and such that she went through at that house growing up. So I think, you know, she kind of entered this life a little, not necessarily guarded, but, you know, it's hard to trust people when you've seen so much cruelty. So friendship is like a special badge that is awarded if Jane gives it to you. And it's making me think of, there's a lot of times in the novel, I think, when Rochester specifically refers to her as his friend. Mm-hmm. And I think that must be very special for her. So, yeah, because he calls her his little friend. And yeah. It's like, we've been friends, haven't we? And all this stuff. And she's like, it's more than that, though. it's more than friends.
I think that that's interesting to me because she does consider him a friend. And like, yes. She does like go into this place where she considers Rochester a friend. And I think that it's interesting to know the level of kind of specialness that holds for her. Yeah. And to go, when Jane looks back on her life, her only friend up until that point is Helen. Mm-hmm. There's an intimacy to their relationship that I think is where some of that, and that's not to say, I have a lot of platonic female friendships that are very intimate. And I think that that's what I see where Jane changes it to that friendship space, where yeah. in order to have friendship, it can't be let's go tell fun stories to each other in the woods and run around. It can't be like we ate meals together and shared jokes and stuff like that. Like that's not enough to be a friendship. It has to be, I shared my inner thoughts and asked this person while they were dying, where is God?
Yeah. Yeah. So I want to just to kind of pinpoint real quick on this discussion, these details that we're talking about of how Lillian and I can kind of see a potential like love, like romantic kind of yeah. love. And again, not sexual in any way, just like, I want to hold hands with you kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. And I see it most in Helen's death scene, because the way that she is so like affectionate, both being like, oh, you're cold, come like, you know, share my blankets with me. She describes how she like kisses her and hugs her. And I don't think it's like a make out on the mouth by any means, but it's like a kiss. And it's, I think there's a sweetness and a tenderness to that. That's, you know, it's not just like, oh, I just, you know, give my friend a smooch. It's my friend is dying tonight yeah. and I love her. In it's a complicated love. And I also love that Helen refers to Jane as darling.
Yeah.
It's one of the ways that she like calls her like right before she kind of, you know, falls asleep and stays asleep forever.
Yeah. But it's stays asleep forever.
I'm sorry. But it's like
that
little
one took a second to absorb into my body.
I don't know. I didn't want to just be like, yeah, then she kicked the bucket.
But that's more earbud style. It's just yeah. like go from like stays asleep to ever to kicks the bucket. Like that's the space we live in. We do not live in the middle there. We're one of the nope. extremes.
Exactly. But those are just some of the details that stand out to me to like lead into that kind of what if.
Yeah. And I do think they did a really good job of discussing that sort of just open door. In the Hot and Bothered podcast. So if that's yeah. something where you're like, if you find this theory annoying, good. Okay, hopefully you skipped ahead and didn't listen to it, and you can listen to our other conversations about it. If you find this theory really interesting and you want to know more about it, there are like articles about this. They talk about it on the Hot and Bothered podcast. I truly wouldn't have talked about it if it was just something I was like, that feels weird. But I think the fact that this is a discussion, this is something that's interesting out there. Mm-hmm. I will say Pride Month is making my brain think real queer. And I've seen so much stuff like recently that, and then the fact that we just watched Gentleman Jack, like my brain is like, all women are in love with the other women around them all the time. And every time a door closes, those women are kissing. And I just have been in the wrong rooms.
No, totally. But okay, so like just a few other like things about Helen.
Really quick before we move on, I do have one yes. other queer fact that I was going to save for the end that I Ooh. Read about this week that I thought would be fun.
Tell me.
So, kind of along the lines of like almost backing this up. And again, if you're someone who feels that you know the historic Charlotte Bronte and the potential theory of new information about her is going to upset you, I'm going to recommend that you skip forward a little bit because this one is a doozy. So like literally this morning, I saw one of the mutual people that we follow, actually the author of Reader, I Murdered Him, the book that we're reading next, posted this thing with a bunch of different period drama or historic fiction. It's fiction about historic time, not time that was written now that's historic. You know what I mean? You know, our whole jam, our whole sleeve. And references to possibly some of these women being different levels of queer. And one of them was Charlotte Bronte. And there is evidence in some of the letters that she wrote to her friend Ellen Nuse. I'm going to send you this in the chat so you can tell me if it's pronounced differently than I think it is.
Ellen sounds like Helen. Coincidence?
I think not. they had a very intimate friendship. They wrote a lot of letters to each other. Those letters can be read in a way that is very romantic. There are moments where Charlotte Bronte writes a letter to, there's a quote where she says, if I was a man and we could, I would marry you. Which like, again, that's something you could say to a platonic female friend, or maybe that you're secretly kissing every time the door closes. And we'll never really know that. But I will also say that it is more often in history that queerness is erased than that it is exaggerated. So my personal headcanon about this actual human person's life, who we will never truly know because she is dead.
She went to sleep and stayed asleep.
Yep, she went to sleep and stayed asleep, and somebody else kicked a bucket near her. I think that that's just an interesting layer of like, it makes some of that intimacy with these friendships seem a little bit more like maybe it was a potential for romance.
Yeah, totally. Also, this last name is a tricky one. I would guess either Nussi or Nussi. Nussi?
If you Google, I'm going to actually put this on our Twitter for sure. Was Charlotte Bronte gay by Out Magazine is the article that I read. And it does, what I like about this article is it does do a really nuanced conversation around how Victorian female friendships were really different than how we read them today and the way that they have conversations. And that it's the same thing that's true for male friendships as well. There was a lot more intimacy in the way that those friends expressed their love, and calling someone dear may not have been as romantic as we read it today. Yeah. Or it could have been.
Yeah.
You don't know, guys. Exactly. And we don't either. Anyway.
They didn't have emojis back then. So maybe she was sending a little winky kissy face.
Yeah. We don't know what else was letters that were too spicy that they just burned those ones.
So one of my, going back to just like basic Helen stuff, one, I love that literally our introduction to her is that she hears a cough. It's like, perfect. That's how she's introduced into the story. Coughs her way into the scene.
I literally wrote on my page, like, that as it turns out, every adaptation got it right. Because every adaptation has just Helen coughing in the background.
Yep, that's what she does. That's her job.
It's her sort of main jam.
So Jane assumes that she is slightly older, maybe 13, when she describes Helen. Helen is, so just in some of like the little details that we get of these early descriptions and observations that Jane makes, because I think she's drawn to her first because she notices her reading a book, and we know that Jane likes to read and escape through stories. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's something that draws her to Helen to begin with. So then she kind of starts to just pay attention to her in class. And while she's observing her, she notes that even though like she responded to all of the questions correctly, this woman, it's Miss Scratchard, right? Mm-hmm.
Scatchard.
Just like, decided that she hates Helen. And that is like such a weird thing. But so like she disciplines her for having dirty fingernails, and she calls her lazy and slovenly, and is always like sending Helen to go stand on the Tower of Misery or whatever, the Pillar of Infamy. And but it's so interesting to Jane that Helen doesn't fight back. She accepts all punishment. And then also seems to just be like not even upset by it, because she's just daydreaming. Like she's standing there in the middle of the room, zoned out, thinking about other things. And so I guess, thoughts on this initial kind of thing?
My biggest thing is, again, to diagnose and or make assumptions about people from the past. Helen has ADHD, guys. That's what this is. Like, reading it, it's like, she's like, I don't know, sometimes I just don't pay attention and I forget to, like, wash my hands and maybe I am slovenly and, like, maybe that is a sin. It's like, or maybe you have ADHD and so your mind wanders away and you're pretty smart and so memorizing bullshit is boring to you.
Like, especially, yeah, if it's like how we saw in the 80s version where it's literally a lady says something at you and you recite it back to her. It's like, this is not how you learn. This is how you memorize.
In case anyone was wondering, I would not have made it through Lowland. I would have dove into a grave and been like, please just throw all the dirt on me. I'm over it.
Lillian's like, can I please go to sleep and stay asleep forever? Thank you. So early parts of these kind of observations about Helen, my notes here are kind of like, I don't like how passive she is. She is a little too, like, perfect, a little too follows the rules because that's what God wants me to do, which is like, so we've talked, I was thinking about this before we hopped on the call. We had talked a lot about how one of our favorite things about all the characters in this novel is that they feel like real people that we know. I don't know anyone like Helen. Helen feels too like she was like perfectly crafted to give Jane the guidance that she needed. And then she dies of a different disease. That's something they talked about in Hot and Bothered, is that everyone else has this awful disease, but she has this very like innocent disease. She didn't get the same illness. She just has this whatever she's got.
Is it typhus that she has, or is that what everybody else has?
I think everyone else has typhus. She's got the one that every like whore in an old-timey movie has where they cough up blood.
She does not have what all the whores have, because that is a sexually transmitted disease that is escaping my brain right now. But yes, like all old-timey people, she dies of a bloody cough.
Yes. It's the classic thing where you cough into your handkerchief, you see the blood, and you're like, okay, the movie's telling us they're out. They're totally dying.
This is going to drive me nuts. I'm going to have to Google it.
Okay, you Google it. I'm just going to keep going on this kind of train of thought where it's like, and so on surface level, I would feel as if this is kind of how I see
it. Tuberculosis,
sorry. Tuberculosis. There we go. Isn't it? Don't all the old hoes have tuberculosis?
No, they have syphilis.
Well, I think in Moulin Rouge, you'll find that
she
does
might
have
tuberculosis, but not all of the old timey whores have. And also, we probably should stop. Similar to switching to fortune teller, maybe we should start saying old timey sex workers.
There we go. Sorry if we're offending anybody. but anyway, so I don't know. There's just hers is the only thing, I think, where it kind of almost feels in line to me with the, you know, hearing the voice across the moors kind of a deal. I feel like she's almost sort of this, she's kind of more of a gothic romance character than how the other people feel like real people. Do you see what I'm saying?
I totally see what you're saying. I do think there are people, I think that it is that innocence of a child, like she's frozen in amber. Helen is one of the characters that, like, I would find, if anybody knows, I'm sure something like this exists. If there anybody knows of like a good version that's like, what if Helen lived and what would she be? Like, yeah. I think she's one of those people that you can only really do this with a child where they're perfect and then they die as a child and they retain that perfection. Mm-hmm. And I think that that really makes sense to me when you look at Helen as a character who is representative of Jane's older sister, who died of this, which is the reason she dies of typhus, is because that is what Jane's sister, or not Jane, LOL, Charlotte's sister died of.
There we go, yes.
And so Charlotte wrote this character that I think is, her flaw is her perfection and her sort of constant angelic nature. But I also think that there is a criticism in that. Like, I think that that's what Jane needed to be pulled away from her sort of fiery rebellion that she had, and to see that there's a way to be this other version of that. Mm-hmm. And I think in so many ways, if Helen had been introduced to, I don't want to say that Helen has had not a harsh reality, because obviously she has a harsh reality. Mm-hmm. But I think that it's very limited. Mm-hmm. And so if she had been exposed to the broader world, if she had met someone, like, I would love to see what a conversation between Helen and Rochester would look like, right? Because I think they're both people who discarded society, and yet they came to very different conclusions about what you should do about that.
Totally. It was, I think, one of my favorite things when we were doing our Christmas episode and like talking about how these characters would interact. I loved imagining that. No, you're right. I think these are really interesting, like just kind of different takes and ways of seeing her, because I feel like, yes, she, on one point, I definitely see the inspiration from Bronte's sister. So yes, you would want to paint that person in an angelic light. I definitely see her role as kind of a catalyst to start Jane's kind of new way of thinking about how to turn the other cheek, love thy enemy, you know, commit thyself to God, because if everyone else hates you, it doesn't matter so long as you love yourself and God loves you and all that stuff. But yeah, I think it's just interesting to me. It's the one character that feels very like this is manufactured for a specific purpose.
Yeah. And I think the other ones, they just are a little bit more seamless in the way that they fit into the space. And I think there is this layer of Helen that I truly find interesting. And I think I want to discuss a bit more around this kind of pivotal idea that Helen has, and we're going to be doing a theology episode here in the next couple of months. And I'm really, really excited for that. We have some very cool things planned. We're going to be having an expert on, genuinely excited. So we're not going to go too deep into the theology around Helen, but she has this sort of like internal understanding of God. And she has this internal experience of faith that is how she sort of finds this peaceful, it's almost like it's interesting because it's almost how I would consider like a Buddhist ideal of like, these worldly things can't affect me because I'm connected to God. So she has that very internally, where Jane at the time is very much aware of and in what the world is and what the world thinks of her, because she's going to this new space where she could have friendships for the first time and people who care about her for the first time.
Yeah.
And I think it's really interesting to, as she's being introduced to something that would make you really want to tie yourself to the people around you and to this world, to be introduced to somebody who, maybe it's that she's aware that she's dying or sick.
No, exactly. That was my main kind of theory when going back over these passages of Helen, is I personally believe 100% she has this mindset and this like personality and kind of way that she moves through life. I think because she knows that she is going to have a very short life and that her death is coming fairly soon. And the way I interpret it is kind of, she seems to me like someone who is like, I need to make my peace because, you know, I don't have much time. And so the way that I've done that is to be comfortable with the idea that when I die, I'm going to like be welcomed into like the embrace of this God that I love and how I see this. And so her kind of finding peace with that, I think, is a big part of how, of just because she thinks, she knows that she's going to die. She's going to take the long sleep and never wake up again. And so she's like finding that peace. And so I loved what you said just then when you were talking about how Jane is finally in a situation where she can make these relationships and Helen is in a situation where she's like, I'm not going to be making many relationships for long because...
Yeah, and I think it's a really interesting, I think there's an interesting perspective. This is gonna get a little dark here, guys, but we are talking about a child dying, so I guess it was always gonna be a little dark. But like, death is one of the few things, there's more things that I think are universally true of the human existence, but death is the one that, like, you can't even argue with me. Like, we are all, I hate to be the one to tell you this, guys, but we are all gonna die. And I think that it's interesting in some ways. I'm coming around. This is something that always happens to me while we're talking about this. I'm coming around. I fully believe that this is how Helen would be, that she does have a realism to her, because this is how a child would experience, like a young teenager. because there is this distance. Anybody who's been around somebody who's had that near death, whether that's an illness mm-hmm. or some frightening accident or some other traumatic event that makes them feel that there's a difference between the knowledge of death and mm-hmm. feeling that, yeah. you can see the way that shifts what's important and what matters. Mm-hmm. And this is how, if you're a teenager and you're dying, you know you're dying, you would go and look for answers. And the people that she has to look for answers from are Broccoli, who obviously doesn't have them. Anyone who looks at that man knows he does not have answers. Miss Scatcherd, who she does find wisdom from, even though I think that Miss Scatcherd is terrible. Mm-hmm. And then Miss Temple. Those are the people she has these answers from. And then she has this other thing, which is the Bible. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where she finds that Miss Temple encourages her in her yeah. own thoughts. Like, the best example of a person she has is encouraging her to think for herself and express herself. And then the best guide that she has is the Bible. And so mm-hmm. she spends her time finding solace and peace there. The Bible has answers. If you're looking for answers about what happens when you die, I don't know that personally, I think they're all right, but they are there.
Right. Yeah. No, totally. And I also love, because like you say, she doesn't just like read the Bible and is like, okay, I believe exactly what is in this text. Mm-hmm. She is wise enough, and I think mm-hmm. In like emotionally mature enough to be like, well, I like a lot of this, but I also have, you know, what I take from it. Mm-hmm. She has her own way of seeing the world. And I've marked a passage that I want to read where Helen kind of shares essentially her creed, and she uses that word exactly. And she says here, so on my book, it's on page 68, but she says, "I hold another creed, which no one ever taught me, and which I seldom mention, but in which I delight, and to which I cling, for it extends hope to all. It makes eternity a rest, a mighty home, not a terror and an abyss. Besides, with this creed, I can so clearly distinguish between the criminal and his crime. I can so sincerely forgive the first while I abhor the last. With this creed, revenge never worries my heart. Degradation never too deeply disgusts me. Injustice never crushes me too low. I live in calm, looking to the end." And so she has this little thing, and it's so interesting. Afterwards, I saw by her look, Jane says, she wished no longer to talk to me, but rather to converse with her own thoughts. And I like how in this beginning of this passage, she says, "I seldom mention this, but which I delight, and I think about it all the time." That was a big deal that Helen shared that mm-hmm. out loud with Jane. And I think after doing so, it's almost like, wow, maybe I shouldn't have shared all of that. I'm a little embarrassed. I'm kind of done talking now. But how amazing that Jane got to hear that and got to mm-hmm. get that perspective. Because yeah, if she's going to die soon, and she might have never shared those thoughts with anybody, but she kind of gifts them to Jane. And I think Jane carries a similar principle onward. And yeah. it's like the beautiful way that, you know, we keep loved ones alive by, you know, keeping their memory with us and yeah. doing good in their name. And I think Jane does that. It's kind of her way of repaying Helen for kind of gifting her this sort of idea.
Yeah. And I think that's such a really interesting way to put it. And I think there's clearly so much that Jane carries with that, even though that conversation like could be really easily dismissed as just like a weird conversation you had with a friend once when you were a kid, right? Like, but I think that you can see that Jane is sort of desperate for those answers and goes back to Helen when Helen is dying, and she goes to her, and we talked about this, like, in some ways, it probably was what Helen wanted to talk about. But in other ways, it's like, can you let this girl who's literally passing away just rest for a second? Because I think that Jane takes that and hears that. And that kind of, that's where her shift from where she starts when she meets Helen of, I would die if people didn't care about me. Like, if I didn't have people who loved and supported me, that would kill me. And she knows that because she's been in a space where she didn't have that. And it was always the hope and possibility of that changing that she had prior. Like, even up until the beginning of the book, Jane is trying to be good to get people to love her. Mm-hmm. And then she goes to this new place and she's like, well, those people were incapable of loving me, but maybe I can be good to get these people to love me. Mm-hmm. And Helen's sort of answer to that is do the right thing, be good for God. And then what these people think doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting to watch Jane live with that. Right? Because like Helen dies with that and she has that peace. And Jane is sitting there asking her, where is God? What is God? Which are not questions you are supposed to ask.
It's incredible. I love just like right out there.
Yeah. And Helen responds with just a really certain answer. Mm-hmm. And she's very sure of what's happening. And they stay together in that space. Jane, I think, takes that as a possibility as opposed to a certainty because Jane keeps going and she has to keep living and she ends up in much muddier moral situations than should you yell at Miss Scatcherd for beating you for having messy hands, right? Like that's as brutal as that is and as clear as that is to me that that's wrong. That is a much cleaner and neater moral dilemma for Helen to grapple with than all of the ones that Jane does through the rest of the story.
Totally.
And I think it's really interesting to watch someone who has so much admiration for Helen and believes so much that Helen has answers, because that's, I would not ask someone I don't respect, where is God? What is God? And actually want to hear the answer, right? Because there's would I angrily yell it at some zealot in a dramatic fashion? Absolutely. But if you're actually, I believe Jane's actually asking Helen this question. Mm-hmm. And I think if you're actually looking for that answer, it's someone you respect. And I just think that it's interesting that she takes this idea and then has to go exist in the world with it.
Yeah, absolutely. This conversation is really making me think of a detail that I loved in the Broadway musical of Jane Eyre, which is so most characters have a theme or a motif. Mm-hmm. And so Helen's theme comes up later in moments of Jane's life, especially after she's fled from Thornfield. And there's kind of this moment of her being like, I need answers. Mm-hmm. And I think of Helen, the girl who like knew who God was and where God was. Mm-hmm. And they play Helen's theme and her motif comes up again as kind of a solace for Jane. And I think that's a really cool way to interpret that musically.
What I find really interesting about the differences between Helen and Miss Temple is that Helen is absolutely somebody who, because of the circumstances she's in, despite very much living in this space at Lowood, is separate from it because she does not really identify. She sort of has this almost dissociation of the criticisms and other things. She doesn't really identify with the negative space that is there because she is so focused on what is to come, because she knows that that is closer for her than it is for everyone else who's there. Yeah. And so the good that Helen does and the sort of existing outside of the rules of this society and the rules of this space that Helen does is so separate from all of that, where Miss Temple is very, very, very tied to the reality that she's living in. She is a single woman who is the head of this school, but does not really have the say and power that somebody like has to break rules in order to treat these girls the way she thinks they deserve to be treated. Mm-hmm. But is at the same time, like, I think has a similar attitude, but with a lot more practicality to it. Yeah. Like, I think Helen sits in this space of like very theoretical, very like reflective and philosophy and those sorts of things, where Miss Temple is a little bit more living in the reality of she is in charge of these girls' welfare and she has to protect them while protecting herself, while knowing that if she's too far outside of what's acceptable here, she will lose her position and her stability and probably her life and won't be able to do anything to protect these girls.
Totally. No, I like this setup, Lillian, because I think it's a great way to look at it that Helen kind of gifts Jane these kind of theological ideas, spiritual mm-hmm. ideas, ways to like things to live by and to contemplate. And I think Miss Temple, the way that she benefits Jane, it is more in through direct action. Mm-hmm. So like some of my notes is that like one of the first things that we get from her, apart from a description, which is quite long about mm-hmm. how beautiful Jane thinks this woman is, but so she notices, well, first of all, she addresses how poor the quality of the food was. The breakfast was unedible. And so then she takes action to amend that by, you know, providing like bread and soup or something for lunch so the kids aren't starving. And similar again, when she goes to kind of comfort Jane after she's been crying after Brocklehurst called her out because he's a total asshole. and then Helen's there too. She is like, okay, so I can't like mend this, you know, thing immediately, but what I can do is provide a comfortable space, come sit mm-hmm. by my fire. I can give you food and sustenance and company and comfort. And so it is, she is, I don't know. It's physical. You're right. Yeah. It's what she can do in the moment, what she can influence. Yeah. And it's very cool to see that.
And I think it's interesting that we never, and maybe I'm misremembering things, but as far as I remember, we never really hear Miss Temple making grand statements about God and what he wants and all of those things. And instead, she demonstrates her beliefs by how she lives and how she takes care of people and what she does in this very practical, very real way. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's so interesting to see how that – because Helen had this very poignant influence on Jane. She was like this very significant moment. But Miss Temple is her only friend beyond that. Like she starts as this, she maintains this very mentor-like position. But like the reason that Jane leaves Lowood is not because she's decided to leave Lowood. It's because Miss Temple gets married and she realizes how much the center of her world this other woman was.
Yeah.
And she decides to move on. And I think that that's really interesting to think about how much influence that relationship had on her during those, 8 years that we jump forward in time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So a few of the notes, in addition to these kind of little acts and gestures that she provides. So there's Miss Temple is also, she does a lot of like little, kind of things of physical affection. She mm-hmm. also gives the girls kisses. She touches them and like just like kind like little gestures, which mm-hmm. I've talked before about how important I think that is for a child as traumatized as Jane is to receive positive physical affection. And so there's a line here that Jane describes when she's in Miss Temple's kind of like little sitting room area when they're having that nice night. Mm-hmm. And she says, "She kissed me and still keeping me at her side where I was well contented to stand, for I derived a child's pleasure from the contemplation of her face, her dress, her one or two ornaments." It goes on like this. Mm-hmm. But this phrase of a child's pleasure, and mm-hmm. I think that older Jane in reflecting on this, I think that's her way of kind of being like this, like, and later she kind of refers to her as sort of a mother figure. But I think it's this thing of her being like, every adult I've ever known has pushed me away and been cruel mm-hmm. to me. And this woman gave me a little bit of kindness. And so I adored her. And I love the way that she kind of phrases that in reflection upon this moment.
I also think something that is interesting as we're thinking about this too is Miss Temple is probably relatively young as well. Like, I don't know mm-hmm. that we get an age for Miss Temple, but she gets married 8 years after she's known Jane. Mm-hmm. So she can't have been, unless she's getting married real old, she's probably in her early 20s at the latest. And I just think that that's so, it's so interesting to put that perspective in it too, of like how, because I think, just thinking about how Miss Temple saw Jane and Helen.
Yeah.
Because she gives these children who need it the most this space to be encouraged to be themselves mm-hmm. in a world that is very much encouraging them to be us. Like they do not care who Jane is. They do not care who Helen is. They want these poor girls to fit this specific mold that they have created, and they are forcing them into that. Mm-hmm. And this woman takes these two girls who that is crushing and pulls them out of that and goes, here in this space, I see you for who you are and you can be who you are. Yeah. And I wonder about how it makes me think about how Miss Helen or Miss Helen, LOL, Miss Temple sees these girls.
You know what? And just now, as you're talking about that, it's curious when you were guessing like how old Miss Temple is. Wouldn't it be interesting if at the time when she's caring for these girls in this early scene, if she herself was like 18 or something like that, mm-hmm. similar to the age that Jane is as a governess?
Yeah.
Like if that's the case, that would be so fascinating, that kind of parallel. And it's sort of that there's like a term that's in my brain here of like, there's like a system that's being passed down of like
yeah.
caregivers of women taking care of younger children and then them growing up and doing the same for the next
yeah.
little like kids who need help. Yeah. But no, that's so fascinating. I love that so one of the things we talked about where Helen is more kind of like philosophical, all of this stuff. I think Miss Temple introduces this kind of concept of justice mm-hmm. and a fair system, because one of the things that she says to Jane is that she's like, hey, every criminal, not that that's what you are, but every criminal gets a chance to defend themselves, you know, mm-hmm. innocent till proven guilty. So tell me your side of the tale. And her just kind of like, I think, presenting that kind of idea forward, where I feel like Jane has only ever been like, the world is unfair, no one cares. And she's like, actually, technically, we're supposed to have these rules. So I'm going to help you find that and like listen and enact it for you. So,
well, and I think it's interesting because Miss Temple is the first adult in her life who did care about the truth. Mm-hmm. Like, and I actually think I always find it interesting the way they play that moment and the way that Miss Temple is in the book, because I always remember being really annoyed that Miss Temple is like engaging in the conversation at all, that she's mm-hmm. engaging in the idea that this child being like telling a lie makes her somebody worthy of being pushed outside of all of society and you can't even talk to her or look at her anymore. Mm-hmm. I'm like if a child came to me today and said somebody at school called me a liar, I would be like, that's okay. Cool fact. Let's not worry about it. Like, it's not a big deal. Sometimes people are going to think you're not telling the truth. Like, that sucks.
Also, I don't know about you. I was a huge liar. All I did was lie when I was a little kid.
Listen, all I'm saying is I remember that. I remember specific stories about Piper. My favorite thing was Piper was the kind of liar who was always really nervous about it and was very afraid of getting caught and did often.
It's just the thing is I thought I was good at it, but nowadays I'm like, I'm a horrible liar. I don't like games where you have to like deceive each other. And I'm like, that's so weird. When little me was like my big ego and confidence, I was like, I'm great at lying, but I was really bad at it.
I don't think you did it. You probably didn't have a great hit rate because the lies were frequent. But I, on the other hand, am great at deception games. And I'm usually quite honest in a way that makes people uncomfortable.
Crazy, man.
But I think it's interesting. I was always very frustrated that Miss Temple engaged in that, because mm-hmm. I can't imagine engaging in that with a child. Yeah. And I think that it is in talking about it more and in understanding the story more, it is so critical that Miss Temple takes the truth seriously and lets Jane explain that truth to her and prove that truth to her.
Yeah.
Because Jane has not had anyone who cared what she had to say or mm-hmm. cared whether they didn't. Oh my God. Aunt Reed. There we go. Whoo. Aunt Reed didn't care what the truth was. She had a truth in her head mm-hmm. and she was just letting everything reinforce that truth. Jane was a bad child because Jane made her feel uncomfortable, and therefore that must be true. And John was a saint. And so everything had to be, Jane was the villain and John was the victim. Mm-hmm. And because of that, because that's the way the person in power saw it, Bessie and all these other people in the household also had to see it that way. And it served John's interest and it served his sister's interests. And so they perpetuated something that the truth didn't matter. And that was really frustrating to Jane. And so having this experience where the truth does matter mm-hmm. and what is real matters. And to Helen, it only matters in your heart. And Miss Temple does a great job of, again, being that example of how these things tangibly happen in the world, mm-hmm. which is she goes and makes it a reality in the world. She goes and finds that witness for Jane. She listens to her and hears what she has to say and says, in my eyes, I believe you now.
Yeah.
But I know that that it's going to make you feel better if we find somebody who can verify this story. So I'm going to go do that for you. Yeah. And I think that that is taking children's concerns seriously mm-hmm. and believing them and supporting them is so important. And it's really interesting to see what I'm now picturing in my head as an 18, 19-year-old girl do that for a child.
Yeah.
And how critical that was for Jane.
I think we talked a lot when we were reading the book in these early chapters. I feel like you especially focused on this was a time when people didn't really think of kids as human mm-hmm. beings. Like they're just like, no, your job is to like shut up and do what I tell you. And then someday you'll be an adult and then, yeah, I guess you'll be fine. But like right now, no, you're a nuisance. I don't want to listen to you or bother mm-hmm. with you or any of this stuff. So I'm thinking about that a lot in how interesting. And maybe, yeah, again, with this idea, maybe Miss Temple is 18. And so she's not herself, not that far from adolescence. Mm-hmm. She's like, hey, I maybe also went to this school and was treated like crap. So I'm going to break the system and like listen to you and get this element of proof so I can share it with everyone else. Yeah. I also think it's so interesting you were saying, why would she engage in that conversation? So I think one way that Miss Temple enacts positive change is that she works with the flawed system. Mm-hmm. So she's like, I couldn't make anything good happen if I like stood up to Mr. Broccoli and was like, how dare you say that to this child? Because he would fire me and then I can't do anything good. So I'm going to listen to his complaint. I'm going to listen to Jane's complaint. I'm going to go get this confirmed from that apothecary. I'm going to come back with evidence. I'm going to supply it to the teachers and the students and say, actually, not a liar. This guy said so. I have two sources backing it up. So we can move forward with this. And she's like kind of she works within the rules of the society to enact good.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those things that I think I've seen this in a lot of different like shows and movies where it's often there are kind of two characters where it's like one person is working within the system and one person wants to bulldoze through it mm-hmm. and be like, no, it's too slow, change now. And it's very interesting to see how those different perspectives kind of, you know, try and do good.
Yeah, I think you and I are going to have to write a buddy cop drama of Helen and Miss Temple solving crimes.
Dude, amazing. I love it. Miss Temple and Helen's ghost.
Yes.
That's our fun supernatural element.
That would be so good. I love it.
Love it too.
Helen literally lives outside of society because she's not alive. She is a ghost.
And she can use her ghost powers to like, you know, slip through a wall and find evidence and stuff.
If you ever are inspired by listening to us talk to write a fan fiction, please tell us about it. We would read the crap out of that.
Oh my gosh. Okay, so I've got like one more little note about Miss Temple before we jump into the rivers.
My only last thing that I want to talk about is just a little bit about how Miss Temple's influence influences the way Jane is with Adele.
Oh, nice. So
I don't know if you want to, I think that leads well into talking about the rivers, so.
Absolutely. Mine was also about how Jane takes influence from Miss Temple. And it's just a couple of passages at the end of Miss Temple's section here. So there's a part, it's right on chapter 10, where she says, Miss Temple, through all changes, had thus far continued superintendent of the seminary. To her instruction, I owned the best part of my acquirements. Her friendship and society had been my continual solace. And then further down, she says, I had imbibed from her something of her nature and much of her habits, more harmonious thoughts. And it goes on. But I love that she kind of addresses there where she's like, yeah, after Helen died, this lady was my favorite teacher. She was my friend, my confidant. And the way I interpret that last passage is that she's literally like, yeah, no, I looked up to her. So a lot of like how I would kind of behave was because I saw that that's what she did. And so mm-hmm. I kind of embraced that. So I liked just kind of noting that.
Yeah. And I think I feel very much I think this is probably, like, we talk a lot about the idea of, like, Jane's childhood and being very rejected is a lot of what influences her to hold Adele closer, as she says, after she finds out about Adele's past. But I think there's also a lot of elements of the people, it's those two, the examples of how to do it wrong and the examples of how to do it right are these two extremes of, you hold that child closer. The child is like who is in this situation where they're outside of whatever the societal ideal is. They need you more. And that influence can be even greater because you have this positive example of somebody who needs that. Like, kids need to be loved and they need affection. And Jane talked, that is very much a theme of this, is that human beings need affection and they will die without it. And it is not okay to not have affection in your life, regardless, like whatever that ends up looking like. And I think that that is absolutely a theme of this, that Jane learns from Miss Temple how to be that for a child. And then she is that for Adele in a way where she does take some of the strictness with her, and she does think that it's important to learn these things, and she wants Adele to understand how empowering this education she's getting is. But at the same time, she's acknowledges that that's a child who deserves to be loved and cared for also.
Absolutely.
What I find interesting about these characters that we're bringing together is the idea that that's what set Jane up for the experience she had at Thornfield. Mm-hmm. And I think, so we're zooming all the way forward, all the way to the end. She's been through all of this stuff and she gets spat out into the world and God goes, here's a light, come hang out over here. and she finds St. John, who I hate and we're not going to talk about today. but she also finds Mary and Diana.
Yeah, and Mary.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I find them, we talked of quite a bit in the book episodes about how much more important those characters are in this, in the book, than they are in most of the adaptions. Although I will say, with the biggest exception to me being the autobiography of Jane Eyre.
Absolutely.
Where they spend a lot of time with them.
No, totally. Yeah, I feel like the movies and the shows and stuff usually kind of, they just seem a little kind of like helpful, but maybe a little ditzy. They're not really like big contributing factors. They're kind of just there and they're like, oh, like, yeah, what if you married St. John? And it's like, no, not good.
Well, and also they're not like quite as pro. They're pro her marrying St. John if St. John doesn't leave.
Yes, because they're like, no, if you do that, one big happy family, he stays here. And she's like, no, he still wants me to go to India. And Diana's like, excuse me, what? I'm like, no.
Well, don't do that.
That's dumb. He's like, you're tiny and you'll die.
Both of you are far too white for this. I don't know how to explain this to you better. The thing that she has with these women is something that she has not had, because she has a relationship with Mrs. Fairfax, but it's not the same. And she has all these other people that she's around. But the other person that she has to have these deep conversations that Jane values so much is Rochester. And she talks about having that for the first time again with Diana. And I think there's so many things within that, in that she has the support and safety to have a space to grow the way she needs to grow in this time away from Rochester. But she also has the encouragement of her thoughts at matter. And then the final thing that I think about with this relationship is it's also not enough. So it's not the only thing that she has with Rochester.
Right.
Just having a friend who understands you and you can have deep conversations with isn't all she needs out of her life.
She's still, as we talked about, pretty horny in this section.
Pretty horny.
And Diana's her cousin, so.
Which isn't a problem at the time, but is, I just think that I don't think they had a romantic relationship.
No.
Because Jane wouldn't have been nearly this horny.
Yes, seriously. My notes on these two are much smaller than anything we had talked about with Helen and Miss Temple, but I feel like the things that stand out to me are that at first they are very much like kind and charitable. That is a big thing. And I think they are genuinely so. Whereas mm-hmm. it feels as if St. John is doing it because he's like, this is going to get me at least 5 god points. I think Diana and Mary, they're not keeping score. They're just being like, we need to help people because we're human beings and we're all in this together. So they have a genuine compassion and kindness. I think it's hilarious when she's like waking up feverish in the bed and they're just like talking about her and they're like, ooh, we made up stories about where you might have come from and what you went through. And I'm like, okay, so they have big imaginations and they're bored out of their minds.
Old timey times were boring.
Yeah, exactly. So they're like, oh boy, a lady we can take care of and like wonder about, a mysterious visitor. I like that they, so she makes mention that they are both employed to like wealthy families, mm-hmm. like in larger cities, but that they're not really seen as like parts of the family. They're just employees there. And I like that the first thing she witnesses, where once again, this is interesting to me, Jane spends, it feels like at least a page or two, just like observing them through their window. So first of all, creepy Jane, but also like, it's the same way with Helen. She spends a lot of time just kind of like watching them and observing them before she's like interacting with them. Mm-hmm. And it's, they're both studying German because they have this desire to improve their situation, because they're like, oh, if we can teach German to our kids, then, you know, we could maybe get paid more or get like better like standing and mm-hmm. different things. So they have ambition. They are curious about stuff. They want to learn. These are just kind of the things that are standing out to me about these two women.
Yeah. And I think they're very much Jane's peers. Mm-hmm. And I imagine for Charlotte Bronte, who always had smart, interesting women in her life mm-hmm. with her sisters and always had that relationship, she would want to give that to her character, who like yeah. is in a space. If you're imagining you go off into this space and you need to change and grow, like what is the thing she creates for this almost sanctuary? It's like St. John is too harsh to just have St. John there. You gotta tame it with Diana and Mary. And I think you're right in that a lot of the adaptions just sort of make them almost props mm-hmm. where they're just sort of the people that Jane goes off walking with, as opposed to that relationship that is so central to giving her that sanity check of like, yeah. he's crazy, right? And they were mm-hmm. like, yeah, no, he's our brother, but he's fucking nuts. Mm-hmm. Like, so I didn't have a ton more to talk about it other than that. I just wanted to, I think they're interesting enough that they're worth talking about in our adaptation that we inevitably make. We will obviously include them, but I think that it's just an interesting bookend that feels intentional to me, that yeah. the book start where Jane's kind of personal growth starts is in these female friendships. Mm-hmm. She has this experience with Rochester, and then she has more female friendships as the core of that next phase of growth. And that's not to say she's not growing with Rochester. Yeah. She obviously is. She goes through a lot with that. But when she's off, she's not doing it on her own. And I mm-hmm. think that is another kind of theme of the book, is that we can't as human beings exist in isolation.
Yeah.
Because she almost dies doing that. And not just because of the way the elements in the world exists, but because of who we are. And mm-hmm. so, and I think that that's an interesting, even as I'm saying that, that's so contradictory to what Helen says, that mm-hmm. we only really need God. And it's contradictory to what Jane says when she leaves Rochester.
Yeah, totally. And Jane tries that. Mm-hmm. She's like, I tried to just like live on the moss and the stone mm-hmm. and it would have been great, but I'm not that little lizard. I'm a human being and I need yeah. to go back to people.
Listen, it'd be cool if we could all just be that little lizard.
Yeah, just chilling in the
moors. Or the gopher that's been living in my backyard. I learned about gophers live alone in a mile of tunnels. They dig a mile of tunnels.
You've been talking to an exterminator.
No, I've been doing Google to see if I need an exterminator and I don't think I need to.
Nice.
We'll just find out together. This could be bad. Ruth is already in a war with this gopher, and the gopher is winning hardcore because the gopher immediately goes into the ground and then goes 6 feet down.
So one other little parallel I want to make, because you talked about, you know, they're like these sisters for her, based kind of like how you know, Bronte pulls from the sisterly relationship she had. Mm-hmm. I think it's so interesting and very intentional that in her childhood at Gateshead. Thank you. I was like Lowthorn Gate. We found it. She has those two cousins. I guess they're all cousins. Yeah. But the first two cousins are kind of, in a perfect world, those would have been her adoptive sisters, but they were awful bitches. And so she's like, no, that didn't work out. But now she has these other two cousins who are the kind of sisterly roles. And I think it's very intentional that it's like, hey, look, these are the nice ones. These are the bad guys. Like, you know, they're just kind of there to fill that void that was like potentially left. And I think it's something not just like friendship and female companionship, but this idea of family. Mm-hmm. That when I love the scene where stupid Sinjin is like, hey, so you're our cousin and you are a millionaire. And she's like, screw that. We're family. She's like, yay. I've never had this before. This is so great. And that's what she wants. And that's like she finally gets that.
Yeah, which I would be excited to find out that Mary and Diana were my cousins. Yeah. And I would be excited to believe that Sinjin can't hit on me anymore because he's my cousin. And then I'd be like, really disappointed to learn that that is not a barrier for him.
He's like, no problem with me, baby. I was like peeling, I was flipping through the pages to find little passages and stuff to talk about. And it really does stand out to me that Sinjin is like, hey, you have a bunch of money. Marry me. And I'm like, dude, you want that fortune, man.
Well, and he's so above it at first because he's like, I don't need this $5,000. You can't just give this to me. And then he's like, but I could get it though, couldn't I?
He's like, but if I married you, I get all of it technically because I'm a man and it's mine.
Yes. It's like, good for me. Anyway, Sinjin sucks is the only... If you take one thing away from this podcast, and I do mean all of the episodes of the podcast, all 73 episodes, I want you to walk away knowing that Sinjin is the worst. And he is the worst. Hate him.
We hate Sinjin. Yes, ma'am. So yeah, I feel like that's all the things that I need to say about these characters.
Me too. What a blast.
We did
it. I love it.
We wrapped it up. There's nothing more to say. No one can ever talk about them again because we did it all.
Yeah, we put a pin in this. You now know everything there is to know about Helen, Miss Temple, and Mary and Diana. One hour? That's pretty good, guys.
Boom. Lillian, what's coming up next? Since we can't rate these characters, but I would give our assessment a 10 out of 10.
I also would give... I give Air Buds 10 out of 10. Basketballs. Because it's a reference to our fun name that we picked, and I now have to spell out for every single person that I say it to. I'm like, it's a pun.
On Air Buds the dog.
It's you know so about the dog movie?
I'll give mine 10 out of 10 waggly tails.
Nice. I'm not putting that on anywhere.
No, it's fine.
But we are going to be doing a little bit of a schedule change. Mm-hmm. We're going to be doing what Piper and I have decided to refer to as summer hours.
Yay.
Because our schedules, I recently started a new contract for work and I am working a lot more now. And Piper, as we have talked about all the time, is getting married at the end of the summer. And so both of those things have made our schedules quite hectic. And Piper wonderfully pointed out that while we love the show, we want to be able to create quality episodes for you guys. We want to be able to put the time in and make these really good. And as evidenced by the fact that this is coming out at least a day late, maybe later, depending on how long it takes me to edit, we are going to be doing episodes every other week through the summer. So there's going to be, if for our patrons, there will be some extra stuff on Patreon because we appreciate that you are sticking with us through our little ghosting time. And I do want to really emphasize that because we're going to be doing these every other week, that is going to enable us to make these really good episodes. I am truly excited for some of the things that we have coming up. And so I really hope you enjoy those. As we pointed out at the beginning of the episode, there's a lot of backlog ones. If you missed any, or if you want to go re-listen, there's a lot of stuff that we have done in the past. So you could listen to an Air Buds episode every week, but we are going to be doing that at least through to September. mm-hmm. For our summer hours.
And we appreciate your understanding, your continued support, and we can't mm-hmm. wait to bring you the best quality of this show that we can.
And just because some of our comment sections have gotten a little weird recently, the last couple of weeks, we've had only positive interactions until the last couple of weeks when a couple of people have gotten very angry about really specific things. I'm just going to say, if you don't want to continue to support us, that would, of course, make me very sad. We love you guys so very much. But you can keep that to yourself. Yeah. You can just stop supporting us and leave. You don't have to tell me.
But Lillian, it's the internet and people are angry.
Yeah. I get being angry. Have you ever considered a journal? Anyway, that is besides. Not for most of you. I don't truly most of you bring me so much light and joy. It's just a couple of people who are chasing us across the internet who are mad.
And it's like, guys, we have a Kmart parking lot for a reason.
Yeah.
That take is, it offline.
That is where disputes are meant to be resolved. If you can't make it, email me and I'll open up the office hours at the Kmart parking lot.
There is a bus stop right there. It's always full of people.
One other random fun fact that I brought specifically to tell you, Piper, because I was watching an episode of Marvelous Mrs. Maisel this week with my grandma. Because she had not seen it. So we watched the second episode. There is a Jane Eyre reference in the second episode of Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. Season 1, episode 2, when they're eating in the diner after the wedding, for anyone who knows Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. Joel specifically is talking about Midge. And she says something about, you love me. And he said, Rochester probably loves that first wife of his, too. And then she went nuts and burned down the house.
Oh, my God. I love that. You see, it's everywhere. Everyone,
it's everywhere.
We can find a way to tie everything to Jane Eyre. It is possible.
Yeah. And yeah. I didn't notice it the first time I read it because – the first time I watched it because I didn't know Jane Eyre, which is crazy to think about.
So crazy. And look how far we've come.
But you did ask me what we were going to do next week, and I didn't actually answer that question.
No worries.
Which is, we are going to be watching a movie. It is a movie that came out in 2022. We are calling it part of our core Jane Eyre, not a palate cleanser, because I want to. And it's the movie Emily that's about the Bronte sisters. Yeah. And I have been told is good and does give Emily steals some of her sister's storylines.
We'll be the judge of that.
So, well, now that we've watched 1 hour long terrible documentary about the Brontes, so we're experts on it.
They better show Bran getting drunk in the streets.
Yeah. If they don't, why are we watching Branwell? You know,
come on.
He's just out here. Okay. So yeah. I think that's it. Follow us on all of our socials. If you want to give us money, we would love that. Mm-hmm. If you give us enough money, we can both quit our jobs.
Woo!
And then we can do we'll do episodes every week, I promise.
Yeah, easy peasy. So that's going to be about 100 grand. We'll take a check. Thank you.
We 100 grand each, please. Thank you.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. leave us 5-star reviews. Tell us about your favorite Helen or Miss Temple or Rivers moment. And we love you guys. And
we do love you.
Happy summer. Stay cool.
Stay cool out there, guys.
Happy Jane Eyre reading, watching. We love you. Bye.
Bye.